matter is submitted. Our next case is, I hope I pronounced this right, Garachi versus Maxwell. So as you're slowly getting yourself situated, as all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, the respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. When you're ready, you can just approach the podium. You can, there you go, adjust it to your level, adjust the microphone to your height, and then please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Prometer. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Gabrielle Geraci. Ms. Geraci was wrongfully denied a harassment restraining order against the man who sexually assaulted her. In denying Ms. Geraci a protection against Jack Maxwell, the court made two critical mistakes. First, the lower court used Ms. Geraci's personal relationship with the respondent to establish consent on the night in question. And second, the lower court held that Ms. Geraci did not meet her burden for harassment restraining order. Ms. Geraci's personal relationship with the respondent was erroneously used to establish consent on the night in question. In this particular case, when the court uses information of the personal relationship for credibility, they are also using it to determine consent. Gabrielle Geraci and Jack Maxwell were the only two people in the room when the act occurred.
Ms. Perlmutter, that may like just actually at that point, the court seemed to be specific that the only important ultimate fact is what happened on the night. But is it not true that the court is allowed, when there's two witnesses essentially present, and there's other witnesses that testified, but to make credibility findings, and part of that would include how the parties conducted before and after an incident. In other words, isn't that a normal, typical, any kind of cause of action, civil and criminal, for a court to make a determination of who the court's going to find, and ultimately has the burden of proof been met? The point here, obviously, even if they're both believable, that's only 50-50, it still would not be granted. So I'm not trying to understand your point about the connection of considering the prior relationship together with all the witnesses, including the roommate, I understand, who came in, and how the parties conducted themselves afterwards to make a credibility finding of whether consent is present. In other words, I assume she said no consent, he said there was.
Correct.
Okay. So how else would a court do that?
Well, let me explain.
Okay.
So 609.341, the statute expressly does not allow consent, personal relationships to be considered in consent. And so when you are saying that Gabrielle Geraci's testimony was not credible, her testimony that she did not give consent to these acts, that testimony was not credible, you are determining that what she said is not true. And when you are using this idea of a personal relationship to determine credibility, to determine that what she said was not true, that she did not give consent, that she is not credible, you are basing that evidence of her personal relationship in establishing credibility that she did not give consent. So it's a two-layered argument.
But would the court have been better off then, from your standpoint, of not referencing that and just say, I don't believe you, and that would have been sufficient? In other words, I find his testimony more credible, which the court did on that issue. Ultimately, the court could have done that without taking into account what happened before and after and their relationship, and that would have been legally sufficient from your standpoint?
Precisely, because in this instance, in this case of sexual assault, determining who consented and who did not consent, who is credible and who is not credible, you cannot use a personal relationship. It's expressly forbidden. And going beyond that, what about this personal relationship determines credibility? This is nothing about her lying. This is not about a crime of dishonesty. This is not her stealing money. This is her saying, what's really being said here is that because she had a relationship with Jack Maxwell before this incident and she had an ongoing relationship with him after this incident, that she more than likely consented. And that is not allowed by the statute. 609.341 expressly says that consent does not mean the existence of a prior or current social relationship. And so while these conclusions are not determinative of consent or of credibility, what they're basically saying is if she went to the Stone Arch Bridge with Jack Maxwell after this October incident, then she more than likely consented. If she went to sushi dinner with him after this incident, then she probably consented. If she had a touchy-feely relationship with Jack Maxwell before and after this incident, then on that night in question, during this act, she more than likely consented. And that is expressly forbidden by the statute. That's exactly what the statute precludes. Go ahead.
I'm still not following completely, but this is obviously a harassment restraining order proceeding. Are you telling me the statute prohibits the court from making credibility findings, which include relationship, but it was much other, there was other specific facts the court referred to in making that credibility finding?
It's my understanding that this credibility finding is generally couched in the findings of what the personal relationship was. It makes up the bulk of the findings of fact. It's expressed, you know, there's a large amount of this opinion that is dedicated to what she did before and after this incident, and it is determined to be used for credibility. But as I said before, this is credibility about whether she's saying she gave her consent or not. And so when you're determining that her credibility is not there and that she did not give, or that she's lying about consent, what you're using this personal relationship for is to determine that she gave consent. Does that make sense?
Well, I appreciate your explanation.
No, I mean, I think I both share Judge Leader's concern, but I understand your argument. I mean, what you're trying to say, well, you tell me if I'm right. You're saying that sort of the improper consideration of the relationship just permeates all the findings and you can't, and taints them all. And therefore even sort of taints the credibility determinations that the district court made as to, you know, for better or worse, the independent witness. I mean, is that a fair statement then, Ms. Perlmutter?
That is a fair statement.
Well, since we don't, and let's say for the sake of argument, there's a lot of test, let's say for the sake of argument, there is a flavor to the findings that you're referring to. Generally, we don't presume error, so even, are we permitted to sort of ignore those observations the district court made and focus on, you know, the key findings it made as to the credibility of the witnesses on the night in question? And if we do that, under our standard review, shouldn't we affirm based on the preponderance of the evidence?
I believe that the key issue in this case was whether or not there was consent. And by crediting the testimony of Jack Maxwell and Bryce Miskovitz, you are necessarily discrediting the testimony of Ms. Geraci saying that she did not consent. So all of these credibility determinations go back to whether or not there was consent. And you cannot use a personal relationship to determine if there was consent on the night in question. So I would agree with the fact that these findings are tainted by this use of the personal relationship. But I would also say that the key issue of determining who was credible goes to consent.
Ms. Perlmutter, we'll go ahead.
I'm reading the memorandum that's attached, and The court says the question is not what occurred before or after the October 16th incident. The question is what occurred in the room between Garassi and Maxwell. This is on page 10 of the memo, which seems to say that the court really focused on what happened on that evening and not necessarily what happened before or after. That's the way I read the findings.
I read the
findings. Am I wrong about that?
I would not say that you are wrong. I would say that he does go on to say the circumstances as they exist before and after the October 2016 incident can, however, inform credibility determinations, and the bulk of his findings of fact do go into those that personal relationship.
Okay. That goes to the heart of my question. But you're saying that's an inaccurate statement of law for the court to have said, and I'll maybe rephrase the question. If I understand your point, would it be a better way to state the law with regard to relationship is the fact of a relationship, and it could include a marriage, does not equal consent.
Correct.
But that does not, isn't that not distinct from saying as a matter of law the court erred in considering the relationship? And part of what I'm thinking of, when you, as you're mentioning, the criminal realm, 63420 allows for the state, for instance, as a victim of assault, to include relationship evidence. And typically the relationship is that there's been ongoing abuse, and that the Supreme Court and this court has confirmed that the reason for that is so a jury gets a better picture, the fact finder, of the relationship. And it would seem like your client's position would be contrary to that very law in 63420, would exclude all that sort of evidence in an assault scenario.
I believe that the personal relationship is relevant to how the parties knew each other, but it's not relevant to credibility in this case, because credibility is ultimately to the issue of whether or not there was consent. And again, it is clearly not relevant to the issue of consent by statute.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Additionally, credibility should be judged on the basis of things such as inconsistencies in testimony, the reliability of the sources of witnesses' testimony, their information, their faculties to observe and recall, and the interest in the outcome. It is our position that the lower court failed to thoroughly examine any of these elements, and they looked at Ms. Geraci's personal relationship with Mr. Maxwell and used that information to determine that her assertion that she did not consent was not credible. The second mistake that the lower court made was finding that Ms. Geraci did not meet her burden in proving that Mr. Maxwell sexually assaulted her. This is an abuse of discretion. Ms. Geraci testified credibly and consistently that Mr. Maxwell sexually assaulted her. There's been several cases, Hansen and Emery, that testimony is enough to overcome the preponderance of evidence standard to issue a harassment restraining order. She's not. Did you have a question?
I do. Is the district court required to issue a harassment restraining order, or is it discretionary on their part?
It's discretionary.
So even if you are correct, the district court in its discretion could have denied the harassment restraining order if they thought that it didn't require one. Is that also accurate?
That is correct. And a harassment restraining order is meant to protect the person who's petitioning for it, not to punish the person that is, you know, being restrained.
So if the court felt that protection wasn't required, they could say, I'm not issuing a restraining order.
Yes. And if the court felt that we did not meet our preponderance of evidence standard, they have the discretion not to issue a harassment restraining order. However, it's our position that we did meet that standard and that there was ample evidence to meet that standard, and that because of that not issuing a harassment restraining order was an abuse of discretion based on the evidence that we provided. There were words to other parties, there were text messages confirming that this incident did occur. And the fact that Jack Maxwell alluded that he didn't do anything, he said that he didn't, rape our client, is implausible based on the evidence. There was definitely enough evidence for the court to find for a harassment restraining order. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perlmutter. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nicole Ketwick, and I represent respondent Jack Maxwell. This court should uphold the district court because the district court did not err nor abuse its discretion. The district court is in the best position to determine credibility, and it did so in denying the harassment restraining order. The record supports no other conclusion. First, the district court did not err in receiving the evidence. A couple points to that. First of all, evidentiary rulings lie within the sound discretion of the district court. Appellant has the burden of proving that if the court erred in receiving evidence, that not only was this an abuse of discretion, but also that they were prejudiced by this abuse of discretion.
Excuse me, was the evidence objected to?
It was not. So.
So there was no objection to the evidence coming in the first place?
Correct. And beyond that, the parties stipulated to the admission of the evidence, and the appellant as petitioner testified first in the hearing. And their first witness that they called was Ms. Geraci, the appellant herself, and she testified about this evidence. The second witness that they called at the hearing was Mr. Maxwell, and they asked him extensive questions about what happened both before and after this incident. So not only did they not object, they sought the evidence themselves in the first instance. So the district court did not err in receiving this evidence. Second, considering the evidence. I disagree with appellant's argument that the district court relied on the relationship evidence to determine consent. And I think the district court order is clear on its face. First of all, on page 9 of the district court order, the district court includes the definition of consent, which is what appellant was referring to in Minnesota Statute 609.341. The very last sentence on page 9 of the district court order defines that definition of consent. Consent does not mean the existence of a prior or current social relationship between the actor and complainant, or that the complainant failed to resist a particular act. And of course, the district court then goes on to explain what happened before and after the event does not matter. What matters is what happened that night. On page 10 of the district court order, the district court says, the court credits the testimony from Miskovitz regarding what he observed when he walked into the room. Appellant says there were two people in the room that night, but there was an independent third party who walked in on the room who the district court credits. The district court heard the testimony, saw the witnesses, and the district court is in the best position to make those credibility determinations.
Ms. Gatwick, so let's say I agree with you, and that the court is supposed to focus on just the night in October. Then why is the court in its findings in 20 talking about what happened in November 2016 and December, where they're saying Geraci, hope I pronounced that right, Maxwell and Arnie went to Topper's Pizza together and then went to the Aqua nightclub where Maxwell carried her out after she became too intoxicated. I mean, that does, well, first of all, you know, that does have an air to it that it's sort of like, well, we should, you know, that does seem to have an air to it that the district court is forming as one of its bases for believing Maxwell over the petitioner, that while they're still sort of going out together as boyfriend, girlfriend, and it seems to me that's the one thing the court can't do.
I think it's relevant for a couple of reasons. Number one is when you have a situation where he said, she said, and there's two different stories, the court's in the position of deciding who they believe. The appellant or petitioner in this case testified that when she was carried out of the nightclub, she was joking around. She wasn't really that intoxicated. Mr. Maxwell and another witness, Ms. Arnie, testified she was carried out because she was so intoxicated she could not walk out of the nightclub. So I think that's a point that goes to the credibility determinations on who he believed on that point that was different between the two parties. So I think this goes to establish credibility and is one an example of something where the parties disagreed on and who he credited. Additionally, to the consent, when the district court credited the independent third-party witness who literally walked in on the two of them while this was happening, that person testified that Mr. Acey, the appellant, was on top of Mr. Maxwell, respondent, and when he opened the door, the two of them quickly separated, and it was as if he was interrupting something. This to him, to that Mr. Miskovitz, the witness, it was clear that something was going on and that was a consensual between the two of them. He then went to the bathroom, brushed his teeth, came back a few minutes later. He testified Mr. Acey was standing up, said goodbye, and then left the room. And the district court credits this testimony. And that testimony goes to consent because she was on top of Mr. Maxwell and they spread apart when he walked into the room, sort of startling them and interrupting what was going on. So that information, which the district court credits, specifically goes to consent. And even if we ignore everything that happened before and after, that point alone, that one witness who the district court credits, goes to consent. And that's what the court credited in finding that there was consent between the parties. Beyond that one witness, though, another witness also came in and testified. And that witness suggested that she spoke to Mr. Miskovitz, and Mr. Miskovitz told her the same thing, a prior consistent statement, that he walked in, the two of them spread apart, and kind of the same thing happened. So the district court credited those other witnesses who said someone walked in when determining you have he said, she said, someone walked in, and that testimony of those two witnesses was consistent with what one party testified to and establishes consent. Additionally, appellant now is asking this court to consider evidence that's not properly before the record. Appellant cites numerous studies, briefs from other state cases that it hopes this court will consider in determining essentially why the appellant acted the way she did. This hearing was set out almost a year after it was reopened. Before the hearing happened, both parties exchanged witness lists and exhibit lists. In that year, appellant was free to call any witnesses they wanted if they thought that evidence was relevant and should have been considered by either the district court or by your honors here today. But that information was not in the record. But even aside from all of that, as the district court said, what matters is what happened in that room that night. And the district court order makes very clear on page 10 that it credits the testimony of Mr. Miskovitz, an independent third party, in establishing consent, and that harassment did not occur. The second argument from appellant that the district court abused its discretion in denying the HRO largely relies on the same information, that consent did or did not occur. For this court to determine that the district court abused its discretion, it would either have to show that there was an erroneous view of the law or that the facts are against logic in the record. And we simply don't have that here. The facts found by the district court are supported by the record. There were 9 total witnesses who testified at the hearing. The district court's 11-page order goes into great detail explaining why it believed and credited the witnesses it did. And the district court is the one who makes those credibility determinations. So this court has those factual findings, and it can certainly review the district court's ruling, but based on these factual findings, this court must uphold the district court. Appellant urges this court to rely on 2 unpublished cases, Emery and Hansen, and I want to talk about those cases for just a minute. The first case, Emery v. Bryant, was before this court in 2013, and in that case, one person testified at the harassment restraining order hearing. One person. And the court credited that person. So the Court of Appeals upheld the district court's findings, saying the one witness who testified was credible. And that came before the court because Bryant, the appellant, argued that she did not prove that there was no consent because she was sleeping. And this court said, basically, no, we're upholding the district court. They don't have to prove anything beyond that, and that went toward the issue of consent. But in that case, one witness testified, and the court found that person credible. That's totally different from this case here today. We had 9 witnesses that testified. Similarly, the district court made those credibility determinations, and this court similarly should uphold the district court based on its credibility determinations. The second case, Hansen v. Burridge, decided by this court in 2017, that case, the Court of Appeals also upheld the district court and the district court's credibility determinations. That case, essentially, they were challenging whether the petitioner proved sexual intent. And based on the circumstantial evidence, the court upheld the district court, saying that was sort of implied based on the acts that happened. So again, the Court of Appeals upheld the district court based on its credibility determinations and finding that the district court's in the best position to make those credibility determinations. So I think based on those two unpublished cases, this court again must uphold the credibility determinations and the findings of fact by the district court. Because the district court in our case had every opportunity to hear the witnesses, to see the witnesses, to judge their demeanor, judge how they came across, make findings on which part is true, which part isn't true, the district court made a lengthy order specifying those findings of fact, and this court should uphold the district court. And without any further questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Gedwick. Ms. Perlmutter, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
As Ms. Gedwick said, this is generally a he said, she said case. These sexual assault cases often are. And that's part of the reason why we used all of these studies to show, to support our argument, that it is so important to really look at how this evidence was used, because these are difficult cases to prove. It is he said, she said. It's whose statement is credible, whose statement is not credible, whose statement about consent is credible, and whose statement that consent was not there is credible. And again, going back to the fact that these personal relationships were used to determine credibility, is that these personal relationships were used to determine whether or not consent was present. To the fact that there was a third party that entered the room, of course, the district court found him to be credible. We would argue otherwise.
Ms. Perlmutter, what finding or where in the memorandum law should we be focusing on to determine that the findings were tainted on the issue of consent based on the relationship evidence? What should we be focusing on?
We should be focusing on all of the evidence talking about finding number 6 on page 2, that Maxwell and Geraci appeared to be very touchy and feely in public, that she would sit on his lap, whisper in his ear, lick his neck, run her fingers through his hair, and they would kiss each other. We should focus on the findings on page 6, the one that you referenced previously, number 20, about going to Topper's Pizza together, the Aqua nightclub together, that Maxwell carried Geraci out after she became too intoxicated. Number 21, that they observed no change in the touchy-feely relationship between Geraci and Maxwell. The fact that he said no change indicates to me that this relationship was strongly considered in determining whether or not Ms. Geraci gave her consent. Finding number 22, Geraci sent Maxwell a topless Snapchat photograph of herself in December 2016, which we would dispute for the record, but it is in the findings of fact. Number 23, there's a whole paragraph here about all of the things that between November 2016 and January 2017 that Geraci and Maxwell continue to remain in close contact. This is evidence that this personal relationship was heavily relied upon to determine what happened in the room on that night in October. There's a huge amount of findings here, discussing their personal relationship. And what this really says is that because she went to the Stone Arch Bridge with Mr. Maxwell, she couldn't have been raped. She couldn't have not given her consent because of this romantic relationship, the seemingly romantic relationship that they had, that she necessarily gave her consent on that night in October.
Do you recognize a distinction of how parties conduct themselves with each other as to whether they're telling the truth at the time about the incident versus using the relationship as the statute prohibits? Do you understand my distinction that I'm asking if you see a distinction there? In other words, we know if we agree conduct of the parties before and after is relevant, would not conduct of these two parties be relevant before and after as long as the fact that they're having a relationship is not the reason the court made that finding?
I believe that the conduct of the relation, that they were having this relationship, is so closely intertwined to the main issue of whether or not there was consent that it is necessarily being used to establish a key point in direct violation of the statute. In other cases, I think that it is, you know, in a theft case, if someone steals something and they're saying, this person stole from me, and they continue to hang out with them, should that evidence be considered, that they continue to have this ongoing relationship? Sure. You know, that would undercut their assertion. However, because of the nature of these cases, because of the nature of sexual assault cases, bolstered by, you know, by the studies that we gave you, by the arguments that we've made, these are special kinds of cases. This is a special sort of circumstance that needs to be seen as separate and different from a typical theft case or a typical murder or something like that, you know? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perlmutter.
Thank you,
Ms. Kettwick. The matter was well argued. The matter is now will be decided within 90 days. Please give my warmest regards to Mr. Benson, Ms. Perlmutter.
Well,
it was nice to see you again, Ms. Kettwick. Our final oral argument this morning is Norman versus